Essay number two, I'm into something good. Part one. As I said, my two remaining siblings, a family friend and I, all retired now. Zoom for a couple of hours every week. Music, a regular topic on our discussion agenda. Next week, I'll be making a brief presentation on Fats Domino, a 50s icon and one of my favorite music people. Great musician for sure, but even more so, such a wonderful human spirit. Among the four songs, our usual number, I chose is, of course, Blueberry Hill, a 40s big band staple that Domino made ultra-famous, his signature piece. If you just let that song start up in your brain, I found my thrill on Blueberry Hill. Chances are pretty good it will be in the voice of Fats Domino. I honestly have no idea yet what Fats Domino or that song have to do with what I am planning to write about here, a series of dreams that ended up with a proclamation to emancipate your brain. But I look forward to finding out. One of the many great gifts you receive when you emancipate your brain, setting it free to do not what you want, which is most likely your brain on late capitalism, that egg sizzling in the money-hot frying pan, and not what you've been indoctrinated by culture to assume is productive work, the bane of American culture in particular, as it pertains to time. But simply what it does, on its own serendipitous initiative, once it is liberated from all of those externally imposed, tortuous, laborious constraints. Antoine Domino toured making his music during the 1950s, another heyday of American racism in a long line of them, having quite often, especially in the South, in those waning days of the most egregious expressions of the Jim Crow culture, many being reinvigorated now in the New South, to eat and sleep in blacks-only establishments, his body enslaved by the cruelty and stupidity of the American imagination. Here's a link to a live performance of Blueberry Hill in 1956, which I provide in the text. I have no idea where the man at that piano ate or slept beforehand, but here, he is the epitome of freedom, his body following what must have been a most fully liberated brain. Domino had a well-deserved reputation for being kind and humble, which you can tell instantly from his smile, his eyes, and his energy, even the timbre of his voice. All of those may seem like implausible, you can't get there from here qualities given his real life experience as a black man in that moment, which is still our moment in many respects. Again, though, only a brain set free can create such a freedom for him to experience, celebrate, and share its gifts against all odds with us 70 years hence. All brains are like that and do that if and when you let them. That's what this essay is going to be about once I get to it, once I let my head wander a bit until it's ready to press the keys it wants to press. In some ways, like Fats Domino at the piano. Yes, he knows the song and the notes, but it's the fingertips that say what that piano has to say in order to create a context and a template for his inimitable voice to take us, literally, if we listen, take us to our own Blueberry Hills, wherever and whatever they were for us, in reality, or with wistful wishfulness. Maybe that's all Fats Domino has to do with what I'm about to write here, a loose connection, like an actual loose connection, throwing off a few sparks until I break the circuit to fix it. But even if you didn't, I enjoyed and appreciated that bit of fireworks, my brain's meanderings, at least in part because it disrupted what I was thinking. And when I use the term slavery in relation to the way we most often treat our brain, what might seem an egregious offense to people of color who know what real slavery is and means, you can think of it more in this belated iteration. Jim Crowish. The taken-for-grantedness of everyday ugly segregation and oppression, rather than the brutality of embodied slavery in 300 of the 400 or so years that preceded Fats Domino sitting at that piano in 1955. I'll start with a dream I had last night in the immediate aftermath of a Zoom conversation I had with a good friend in Colorado. One in which, among many, many other things, I narrated a series of dreams I had had on the four consecutive nights preceding our talk. I had no intention to have the dream I had last night. I was hoping I might have another in what was by then the ongoing series of my dreams, each of which pertained to and offered solutions to the problem of the divided up, broken off selves I live with, that we all live with. The pieces of our once integral self that got separated from their source by culture, as in race and gender stereotypes which start way before we are even born, or by choice, as in the things we decide or give up, not out of desire, but in deference to need, or by happenstance, those accidents of circumstance that abbreviate certain life paths and necessitate others, or by trauma. Those life events, some overwhelming, some surprisingly small, that arise in our minds thereafter over and over, always with angst, turmoil, or literal pain. A dysfunctional, un-Blueberry Hill-like variation on, though we're apart, you're a part of me still, which has been my main concern lately. I didn't specifically ask my brain to solve or even explore these problems for me. They were just on my mind currently. And my brain, like yours and everyone else's, is quite often willing, even eager, to take on challenging matters. A way to flex itself, maybe. For me, when that happens, the answer is quite often delivered to me cryptically via a dream. One that stands out enough from my routine REM patter that I remember something from it when I wake up, and, if I'm smart, write it down, a phrase, even just a word, before I forget it in the ongoing amnesia of wakefulness. The main trauma that has been on my mind for some time now originated with my wife's sudden passing 6.5 years ago. The moment I found her when I came home from work on what had seemed before that like just another normal day. In the interim since then, I've written 10 books, prose and poetry, recorded numerous albums of songs I wrote, read voraciously in multiple philosophical and poetic arenas, as well as many, many books pertinent to race and gender in keeping with the crises of this historical moment. Retired, moved across the country to set up a brand new life, worked assiduously on my mental health, and for all apparent and practical purposes, have reinvented a happy and normal life for myself. And I am truly and deeply happy, no lie. About 3 months ago, though, out of the blue, all of that work just stopped, on its own, I mean. The things I had been making almost manically and all the multimedia ways I've invented to share them, primarily with family and friends. Most of the reading, except for Chinese poetry and quantum physics, which are my relaxation topics now. All of the directed thinking that animated that work, well, it just stopped. My moving to a new place with my reclusive temperament, both of which truncate one's social life, amplified then by the obligatory isolation of the now nearly 2-year-long pandemic, means that my local social network is extremely small. Basically, my daughter and her husband who live nearby, the couple who own the house I rent, and a couple of recently met friends. I am, of course, in ongoing conversation with others, family and friends, remotely by phone, Zoom, email, etc. But my immediately embodied community is a small one indeed. After I moved to Olympia, I made a strenuous effort to connect remotely with as many friends as possible, some back in Pittsburgh, where I worked for 40-plus years, colleagues, others scattered around the world, former students, in the hopes that they would enjoy being in conversation with me. No big deal there, nothing I needed or expected. I just enjoy exchanging thoughts with other thoughtful people and wanted the comforting, ongoing company that such interactions offer. I'll call what I had in mind intellectual dialogue, if you think of the former term very loosely, like maybe the kind of animated conversation you might have about things pertinent and or strange in a bar or a coffee house. You would think university clientele would be keen for that. You would be wrong. It worked kind of jerkily for a while, brief and often months-delayed responses to my entrees, the kind that say that a routine Christmas card-y conversation is acceptable, but nothing too deep or personal. Unlike most people I know, I enjoy deep and personal way more than Christmas card-y. So those relationships gradually withered, as equitable two-way streets, I mean. I finally concluded that if the energy I was investing in them lapsed, that they would lapse too. A couple of months ago, along with all the other things that lapsed, that energy did too, and most of those relationships followed suit, adding an additional layer of quietude to my inner life. I want to make clear that none of these stoppages, the writing, the thinking, the reading, the remote dialoguing, felt intentional on my part. In much the same way that everything I've been making, sharing, and doing these last 6+ years has felt to me, and I've written about this multiple times, largely out of my conscious control. The books and songs especially wrote themselves, as far as I could tell. I just provided the synapses and the fingers for those circuits to complete themselves. And then, on June 6th, it just stopped. Oddly, rather than feeling like just another array of losses to me, small aftershocks from the big one, it was as if I were set free from the inside out, my head blessedly blank, which has been my favorite way to describe it in the meanwhile, instead of churning. It has been that way for 3 months. I have no idea how much longer that state will last, and I don't care. I still take my daily walks in the woods or down to the bay, read the few remaining kinds of books that interest me. I do my household chores, watch some TV, from the most pointless car repair shows to the most interesting documentaries on science, nature, and art. I make healthy meals for myself with the fresh foods I buy locally, and I sleep. Perchance, lately at least, to dream. Part 2. Let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be. There will be an answer. Let it be. As I mentioned in The Bodhisattva Asks, one of our little musical projects for my weekly family Zoom was to pick out 3 snippets from songs delivered one by one over a 3-week period that have had and are still having a memorable impact on our lives. This one from the famous Beatles song has been on my mind all summer here. Just a wondrous time for me. 3 months of nearly perfect weather. All the sea, sky, woods agleam with light, the inside of my head mimicking that quietude on a scale I've never experienced in my life. All so magical for me. It has been as if the weather inside and out has just said, let it be, let it be. There will be an answer. All for me. I used it as my second pick. So, about those dreams I had last night, the process of emancipation, the business of this essay. My friend and I have an ongoing conversation about working efficiently, something that I have always been assiduous about my whole life and that she struggles with. The three dreams that seem to me to pertain to this were quite straightforward. I sleep wonkily and tend to wake up after every dream cycle at night, so I often remember at least fragments of the dreams that have just finished. Writing down a few words if it seems worth doing that. After the first dream last night, I wrote down, "The deck is switched off." Much of my friend's work involves creating elaborate series of complex PowerPoint slides, which she calls decks. I've seen and reviewed for her some of them, so I know how easy it would be to become absorbed in their intricacies, a kind of infinite recursive process. What this dream seemed to me to be saying was to develop the ability to put a halt to that, to say with finality that the deck is now off. That is, good enough in its current iteration to satisfy all the parties involved. That seemed kind of trivial to me. Easy to say, hard to do, I mean. So I just went back to sleep. At the end of the second dream cycle, I wrote down, "Then walk off." Clearly, the next step in the process of letting go. That too might seem trivial, but part of our conversation earlier in the evening had to do with doing as a driver for, rather than an outcome of, thinking. In short, the ways in which behaviors, the body acting, serve as powerful agents of change, more so, for example, than words, which are quite weak by comparison, at least in part because we are inured to their effects and in part because our culture has generally severed the relationship between saying and doing, as if words alone are enough to promote change, which they aren't. As Fats Domino laments, "All of those vows you made were never to be." So in this case, the advice was to literally walk off for as far and for as long as it took to put the deck fully to rest mentally. 5 feet or 5 miles, no matter, until the deck's hold on the brain is broken. I figured that would be it, so I went back to sleep. The next dream cycle went off in a different direction and took me quite by surprise. When I woke up, I wrote down, "We treat our brains like slaves and need to emancipate them." I assume this was not directly connected to the previous two dreams, but now I thought I was getting somewhere. Not just with my friend's immediate problem with work efficiency, but with something larger and more complex. The ways in which, as I said earlier, we treat our brains in the same way as the Western economy treats labor, either buying its time and pushing it to its limits until all it can do is eat and fall asleep. The 19th and 20th century factory mine model. Or tricking it into believing that it has all the time in the world to complete its obligatory tasks, so it spends all of its time forestalling completion, parceling out smaller and smaller segments until every available second is consumed, but hardly anything gets done. That is, simply perseverating, the term my friend prefers, on things that, for all practical purposes, are already done or easily could have been. As if they can be made better, even perfect, when infinite mental time is devoted to them. Mental time that you know, if you work that way, is rarely very productive and is always enervating. This allows late capitalism to achieve an even more insidious form of control over workers' mind bodies than early capitalism did in the factory mines, driving them to exhaustion. Except in this case, the man doesn't even need a building, a production line, a foreman, or a time clock to make it stick. We take on all of those roles internally and enforce them ourselves by turning our own brains into slaves on behalf of agendas we actually care very little about. Don't get me wrong. I have no objection to work, even pointless work. I've done tons of it with dedication and pride because I had to in order to get paid to support myself and my family. That sort of work is just as honorable as the work my grandfathers did in the mines. The difference I want to highlight is this. Those factory mine laborers 100 years ago, and those who do that work now, know in every fiber of their being that their bodies and minds have been indentured in the service of someone else's agenda and wealth. They work assiduously between punch-in and punch-out. Then they go home and try to recover and enjoy life. The economy of late capitalistic professionalism hides this reality quite cleverly from its workers, actually buying far more of their time by creating the illusion that their self-worth, their identity really, is implicated so deeply with the work that it becomes all there is. There is no time left for anything else, including recovery and enjoyment. I was fortunate to have been born with an aversion to work. So that ploy became visible to me when I was just a boy. I never gave my time away like that, and retired now, never will. The key, of course, is first to see how and why this is happening, which is hard. Even when you do, though, finding a way to stop doing it may seem like a formidable, even insuperable task. But my two simpler dreams I now see offer some keynotes to start with. That it was more a function of stopping things than starting things, walking off rather than working on. When I thought again about the first dream, it no longer seemed so trivial. I became enamored of the metaphor of the switch. I've struggled all my life with anxiety-related problems, and I have a head that can be quite hard to switch off once it gets going. But I have, over the years, found ways to get access to at least some of the most pertinent switches and developed the ability to flick them off when I want. I won't go into a lot of detail here about the hows of that. One essay of mine that is clearly pertinent and is all the time in the world. The swan song talk I delivered in the English department at Pitt in advance of my retirement, which I include as a postscript to this book. For me, control over time was the essence when it comes to liberating my brain to do what it is best at, what it craves the opportunity to do, instead of the many routinized, often arduous, sometimes pointless tasks it was either obligated to do while I was employed for me to keep getting paid, or now when I'm retired for me to keep eating, for example. As that essay points out, once you take control over your own time, the available time is amplified exponentially, seems sometimes almost infinite. But I guarantee that if you turn that switch off, you will be stunned to find it is absolutely true. The second dream, then walk off, is applicable to the matter of emancipation in these complementary senses. The activity of walking, especially taking a walk outdoors, has been demonstrated by practitioners, poets, spiritual leaders, philosophers, psychologists, and tons of ordinary people, to liberate the brain from its routine tasks and to open the mind to new, often surprisingly unexpected ideas. Much of what I've written since my wife passed has arisen in my mind, of its own accord, totally out of the blue, as in, where the hell did that thought or that series of words come from during one of my daily walks? But emancipating one's brain requires an even more radical kind of walking away. One that basically says, as often as possible, that you will cede executive control over your intellectual functions for as long as you can. I've written about this quite extensively in Living Hidden, in the two chapters on identity. So again, I won't go into a lot of detail about it. But the John Lennon song above is a good capsulization of the gesture most essential to getting free. Let it be. Let it be. Just let it be, for God's sake. Sooner or later, there will be an answer. One you will not have to do any apparent work for. Here's one recent experience that serves as an example, and it got me thinking about how the brain may actually prefer to function on its own, without our making it behave slavishly in service of our ephemeral preferences. Last spring, in one of our family Zooms, I mentioned the half-sister of someone we knew in the neighborhood growing up. She lived a couple of houses over for only a year or two, at my grade level in junior high school, but was memorably sweet, to me at least. I've thought about her visually many times since then, at least in part because she had many of the physical features my wife had: black hair, a refined porcelain complexion, alert, haunting eyes. But I could never think of her name. In any case, I tried on and off to recall it and couldn't. Somehow, my head going quiet in June created a space for my brain to go about this work in the background, on its own initiative. About 2 months later, while I was eating breakfast, her name gurgled up to the surface of my consciousness. It felt as if it was a fish I was reeling in from the deep in the ocean. And there it was, just like that. This is, of course, a common human experience, the background brain solving problems for us. I had experienced it repeatedly before, as you certainly have. But this time, my reaction was to imagine what it might be like if I just turned my brain free, maybe posed questions or problems for it, then walked off, not even bothering to think or write about them. Just wait until whatever my brain was able to accomplish gurgled up in its finished form for free. That, I thought, would be quite cool. And that's what I've been doing. And it is quite cool. Part 3. I woke up this morning feeling fine. There's something special on my mind. Last night I met a new girl in the neighborhood. Oh, something tells me I'm into something good. That's the opening of one of my favorite Herman's hits. Part of a playlist of my own Herman's Hermits covers I listen to quite often now in my morning walks. You might be wondering, as my siblings do, why a guy of my age would be singing this sort of bubblegum pop, imagining he's met a girl in the neighborhood who walked him home hand in hand, said he could see her next week. Nothing but a silly teenage fantasy. Well, I'll tell you, this song and all the other Herman's Hermits songs I covered, and a similar playlist of Buddy Holly's songs I recovered, the first of which starts this way. Every day is getting closer, going faster than a roller coaster. Love like yours will surely come my way. Hey, hey, hey. They make me happy. Not so much to remember a simpler and sweeter time in my life, which they do, but to help me to imagine that I am still young at heart, flush with hope and life, even if my body doesn't quite fit the part. These songs fill me with an actual belief that one of these days I might happen into something good, and love like that will surely come my way. Okay, so it's a million to one. But I guess I enjoy feeling like Jim Carrey in Dumb and Dumber, so you're telling me there's a chance? Why not? It's way better than the array of grim fantasies that our culture creates for people my age to wallow into. The nice thing is, it doesn't really matter if that happens. I have been on my own for going on 7 years now, the first 4 of those extremely difficult to handle alone. Now, I'm generally happy with things just as they are. To be honest, most days I can't even begin to imagine how I'd negotiate a new relationship after 40-plus years essentially on the bench, or whether I'd be able to accommodate another essential presence given how flakily free I now feel. Or maybe more to the point, whether another essential presence would be willing to accommodate me the way I am, which is fully myself, flakily free, and intending to stay that way, for better or worse, for richer or poorer, in sickness and in health, to love and to cherish, till death do us part. Or something like that. I like those silly songs, not for what they promise, but because they allow me to imagine a wonderful life without longing sadly to live it. I've had one great life already, and as I've said repeatedly over the years, in this world, one is the difference between everything and nothing. No two ways about it. My brother in particular always grimaces when I bring up my continuing affection for Peter Noon and the boys, and I bring it up at least in part to aggravate him in a playful way. I actually picked this stanza as my very first selection in our three-part song snippet assignment, and I meant it. Why I'm writing about this song right now is still not clear to me. Again, I guess I'll have to write what I write to see if or how it fits. One thing that crosses my mind immediately, though, is how often I wake up in a good mood these days. One of the reasons for that is I often follow a very specific emotional progression in my dream sequences. I don't sleep especially well or deeply, so as I said, I wake up after each REM cycle, maybe every 90 minutes. Early in the night, my dreams tend to be dark and scary. I often wake up a little shaky with a low-level headache and think, oh, it's going to be a rough night, Paul. But as the dream cycle proceeds, it moves gradually toward the light, a resolution, sometimes a very important one. Last night, for example, my first dreams were about a troubled relationship I started and ended between my marriages, one that has afflicted me on and off for a variety of reasons in the intervening years, just the unsettledness of it. I attempted to initiate a conversation with this woman about a year ago, hoping maybe to resolve things, and was quite rudely rebuffed, reigniting my dormant resentments. My first couple of dreams brought all of that burgeoning to the surface. But in my last couple of dreams, I actually had a chance to sit down and talk with her, find out more about her life now, the intervening years, her feelings back then. It was wonderful. The various kinds of angst I had felt all of those years were transformed into a deep and authentic compassion. The very word I chose when I woke up to describe to myself my attitude toward her. I actually felt that I understood her as a full human being for the first time. That's a lot to get for free from your brain on dreams with someone you haven't spoken to for over 30 years. Which does get me back, I see now, to what I set out to write about way back with Fats Domino, which I had almost forgotten. A series of dreams I had not during one night, but over a four-night cycle in late August, the 27th through the 30th, all pertaining in one way or another to the recovery process I turned over to my brain early last June. The general assignment I gave it was to help me with the remaining elements of the trauma of my wife's passing. I've been working on that for over 6 years, doing really well, but something inside said to me, now is the time to take the next steps. Not necessarily to finish the process, which is, of course, impossible without the option of time travel to change history, but to address the matter directly. The feeling was so pressing that I resigned all of my local obligations to make room to deal with it. The first night's dream had expressly to do with trauma. All I remembered from it was that the traumatic image, the visualized originary event, I mean, was like a decal applied over a huge, much more amorphous emotional reservoir, the actual impact of the event on a deep level. The first step in the recovery process was to peel the decal off, that is, to separate the visual image from the emotions. This, the dream indicated, might prevent that image from flashing up repeatedly and unexpectedly into consciousness, as such traumatic images do, dragging its emotional cargo with it. This does not, of course, resolve the trauma, but it makes it possible to begin to deal much more directly with the emotional cauldron the image tends to mask. I've been experimenting with various attempts at this. I mean, getting the details of the scene out of my head and feeling what's left when I do, and I think they're working. I can actually name emotions and feelings now, delve into them from what I would describe as a quasi-rational point of view. Not a clinical awareness, of course, but also not simply a traumatically induced brain freeze. One of the afterthoughts in the dream, at least according to the notes I scrawled, was that if you want to change how you feel, first change how you act, which is akin to the walk-off message in the dream I had from my friend. That will sooner or later change how you think, which will change how you speak, which will change how you feel. I assume the implication was that you can't change feelings directly, simply because you want them to be different or go away. You have to do a lot of work, and it takes time and patience. But before you do any of that, you need to peel off the decal, which I've done to the best of my ability and have started the rest of the process, which I like, though it is not far enough along to verify that it works. In any case, I'm finding this dream to be quite useful. The next night, the dream I remembered and took note of was a scene in which I was in some sort of a psychologist's office taking a battery of tests to determine my general well-being. The therapist was a very handsome woman in her 40s, tall, thin, shorter, curly black hair, fine-featured, smiling, with the kindest demeanor. The first test had something to do with puppies, which were in some kind of distress, sick or dying. I just can't remember enough to know for sure. I had to attend to them, and I did. I have no recollection what I did. The second test involved breathing into a long tubular instrument of sorts, like a car exhaust made of bamboo. When the woman demonstrated it, the effect on the sound was interesting. She would sing a long note, but all the sound would disappear once it entered the instrument. So I did the same, sang a very low tone and held it for a very long time. When I was done, the therapist stood up quickly, walked over, and embraced me with the warmest hug. As she separated, she tried to kiss me gently on my right cheek, but she kind of missed, ended up half catching the corner of my lips, so sensuous to me, both such beautiful gestures, despite the awkwardness she seemed to feel about it. As we separated, she said enthusiastically that I was just amazing. The most amazing person she had ever met, that my performance on the tests was off the charts, and I was ready to go off on my own. I think this dream speaks volumes all by itself, so I'll stop there. The third night's dream, at least the part I remembered, was a simple scene. I was in my living room and could see someone standing outside the window, just standing there, about 10 feet from the door. I opened the door and saw a boy of about 10, very thin and pale, his arms folded in like he might be cold, looking sullen, forlorn, not sad or desperate really, not asking for anything, just standing there, as if he had been waiting patiently for decades. I could tell immediately that it was me at that age. I remembered everything about how he looked and felt and why. I just smiled and said, "Why don't you come in now? We need to be together." I put my arm over his shoulder He smiled warmly, and basically he moved in with me. Again, I think the dream speaks for itself. The final dream in this series involved driving up the ramp of one of those circular parking garages. My purpose, I knew, was to find all the cars I had lost in there over the years, forgot where I parked them, for example, or just never came back for them. I often have dreams about forgetting where I parked my car, with all the anxiety attendant to that. In this case, I picked out one after another. Each one, I somehow knew, was some aspect of my identity that had gotten misplaced along the way. And with each new discovery, and I could see and find them all, I became fuller, richer, more and more myself. It was a wonderful feeling. On the top level of the garage, I saw my mother and father, both passed now, just standing there, as if they were waiting for me, a little anxious looking, I thought. I got out of the car with a huge smile on my face, told them I was fine now, and kissed each one of them on the cheek. Again, I don't think you have to be Sigmund Freud to figure this one out. And that was that. I had no more dreams in this series. But I think you can understand why I woke up each of these mornings feeling fine, with something special on my mind. I did meet a variety of new people in this neighborhood. And yes, something tells me I'm into something good.